Welcome to the Class of 1987 podcast. I am your host, Tim Harkness. On this podcast, we will be speaking with members of the Yale College Class of 1987 about their lives, where they've been, where they are now, and where they are going. We plan to cover a wide range of topics and have people who represent the full range of our class's experience. The class of 1987 is the best class that Yale College has ever had, and we're here to celebrate that. So sit back and listen to what your classmates have to say. Hi, and welcome to the latest edition of the Y87 podcast. With me from Laramie, Wyoming, we have Sharon Buccino. Welcome, Sharon.
It's great to be here. So nice to have the chance to talk with you.
Yeah, this is great. Well, you know, what are you doing in Wyoming? What are you up to?
Yeah, so I've been here with my husband for a couple of years now. It was just before the pandemic that we decided to move here, the Washington, D.C. area, where we had been really almost 30 years. And I'm continuing to work as an attorney for an environmental organization, the Natural Resources Defense Council. But we came here because my husband took a job. We met in law school, Stanford. He took a job teaching at the law school here at the University of Wyoming.
And so you went along. So it looks to me, looking at your background, that you've spent pretty much your entire career dealing with environmental issues. Is that about right?
It is. And it's interesting because I didn't go to law school knowing that's what I wanted to do. So that was the, you know, graduated in 1990, so end of the 1980s. A few law schools had a curriculum in environmental law, but not really many. And there wasn't one really at Stanford at the time. And I have to say, it was really being out in California that really solidified an interest in doing environmental work. And it was kind of the power of places, you know, like Yosemite or Point Reyes National Seashore, that I would say first drew me to environmental work, but it's really been people that has kept me in it, both the people that I've gotten to work with, but also the fact that now working on environmental issues is really so interwoven into the lives and the quality of life that people live every day.
Yeah, I was reading the other day that environmental issues really aren't about the planet anymore. They're really about the people, where people are going to live, where they're going to be displaced, how our world will be shaped. It sounds like that's impacted you. Now, why don't you describe a little bit what you do? Because as I understand it, you do some litigation and some policy work. Is that right?
And
then
that's
for
right.
Those who are not lawyers, what the hell did that mean? I know what I just said, but how would a layperson understand what I just said?
So right now, I direct the lands work, the Natural Resources Defense Council. And it's true, and it's probably a little bit unique now. I mean, I really have spent pretty much most my career at NRDC. And part of the reason I've stayed so long is I have gotten to do a lot of different kinds of things as an attorney for NRDC. I actually got hired to work as a clean air attorney. There were three attorneys working just on the implementation of the 1990 amendments to the Clean Air Act. I then moved into doing all legislative work, which is not kind of what I necessarily had gone to law school to do, but it was, this feels a little bit like talking about history now, but with the 1994 election, and it was when Newt Gingrich kind of came in and had a very anti-environmental and anti-government agenda. It seems a little bit tame compared to what we're facing now.
Well, I guess it might have been the first step down the road we're on right now.
But it was the first time, actually, that NRDC hired a legislative director. And I worked as then a pretty junior attorney with him basically marshaling the expertise that existed throughout NRDC and bringing it to Capitol Hill and using it to influence policy there. And I definitely still do some of that a lot. I've been very involved in the debate around the infrastructure bill right now. But I've also been able to keep my hands in litigation. I feel like litigation is a very powerful tool, but I'm glad to be at a place like NRDC where it's not the only tool.
You mentioned you were doing land work. What does that mean? Are you talking litigating about the way federal lands used, private lands used? What land are you talking about?
Yeah. So for the most part, our work is about the federal lands, the public lands, the lands that we all, each one of us, own. And so it's utilizing the statutes like the National Forest Management Act, the statute that has the acronym FLPMA, which Federal Land Policy and Management Act, governs all of the lands that are managed by the Bureau of Land Management across our country, which is a lot more acreage than, say, our national parks. So it is. I mean, so my litigation is mostly challenging government decisions that we argue, and most of the time, because we pick our cases carefully, succeed at arguing that either, you know, the decisions that are made, say, to could be related to oil and gas drilling, pipelines, transmission, that those decisions either are not consistent with the mandate the land management BLM, the land management agency, has, or a lot of times they have not done the analysis the National Environmental Policy Act requires that governments undertake to ensure, one, that they're making informed decisions, but two, that they've involved the public in those decisions.
So do you have a case during your career that you're most particularly proud of, a moment in court or a result that you say, boy, I really made a difference?
So that's a great question. You know, it's interesting because I think I was drawn to litigation because I do have this competitive strain in me. And it's one of the things that characterized my experience at Yale as well, because I got very involved in intramural sports. And all of our listeners shall remember that in 1987, it was Morse College that won the Ting Cup. And so I had been the athletic secretary along with one of our colleagues in that success. And so getting back to your question, so I've done litigation as long as I've been able to win, because there's a great feeling from that. But I have lost a few cases as well. But, you know, it's interesting that I guess the case that I remember the most actually did not involve land work directly or the land management statutes, but instead involved the Freedom of Information Act. And I was involved in NRDC's efforts. Actually, we sued in federal court to get access to the Cheney Energy Task Force papers, which again is a little bit, seems a little bit like history rather than kind of present day. But that, you know, in the early 2000s, we were beginning this conversations that we're still having today, which are, you know, what is the right energy, national energy policy for this country, and how do the federal lands fit into that? And at the time, those conversations were pretty one-sided. And so we used the Freedom of Information Act to get access to those records. And I guess one thing that made it so exciting was that it was more than a case. I mean, it became part of a narrative and a story that kept being played out in the media. And so it was a good example of how we were, as an advocacy group, able to use a lot of different tools to shape what we felt was the right direction that the country needed to take in terms of an energy policy. And it was an energy policy that moved away from reliance on fossil fuels and started to invest for the future in cleaner, renewable energy, whether it was wind or solar.
So, you know, with the changing political winds altering what's possible in your field and the interests that compete against the viewpoint that the NRDC puts forward, how do you stay motivated? I mean, you've been doing it for a very long time, and to stay motivated and keep at it when there must be times of immense frustration interspersed with times of success and hope. Like, how do you modulate that?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And I think that the root of the way I'll answer that is that I've made a point of making sure I do things that allow me to sustain that hope. I would describe myself as basically a hopeful person, which is, I guess, one reason why I've been able to stay in this. But I think also doing things, and to be honest, moving to Wyoming was one of those things that keep the issues fresh, that keep me energized. And as I look back and reflect on kind of the twists and turns and the path that took me to where I am now, I see that in some ways I really have always been drawn to the wild. And it's what drew me from the East out to California to go to law school. It then took me to Alaska after that, where I worked for the court system. And so now I feel like I really, in some ways, have traded the wilds of Washington, D.C. for the wilds of Wyoming. And part of that is because I felt like, look, I've been working on these issues with the same people in the same way, having the same conversations for a long time. I mean, it's been over 25 years. And I want to spend this last phase, I need to spend this last phase of my professional career working in a different way and working with different people. And part of it is that at first I was drawn to opportunities on the coast. I mean, it was in school and then work, but there's a lot more to the country, as we're all seeing, than its coasts. And so it was very intentional to come to Wyoming to really work. I mean, I'm still working on the same issues, but working on them in a different way. Talking, I think the conversations, we have to be having conversations about these issues and conversations with people who don't necessarily think like I do, you know, in the same way. And that is easier.
Yeah. How has it changed? How are having conversations with folks from Wyoming different?
Yeah, well, I just, for one, it makes a difference that you're going to keep seeing these people that you're talking to. I mean, Laramie is a pretty small town. It's got about 30,000 people, but 15,000 of those are students at the university. And so I think it does make a difference that you can't burn bridges when you talk to people about issues. And I'm in this to solve problems, and that takes talking to people. And I think what I found is that over the over the 25 years that I spent in Washington, it became very polarized. I mean, as an advocacy group, all advocacy groups were forced kind of to the corners where there wasn't much conversation. There was a lot of pressure to posture rather than just really talk about the issues. And so it is refreshing that it's, I think the conversations are easier to have when you're working on the issues from the ground up.
Literally from the ground up. Okay.
Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you're enjoying the conversation. Please remember that this podcast is being brought to you by the 35th reunion of the greatest class Yale College has ever known, the great class of 1987. Our reunion will be in New Haven, Connecticut, June 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th in Pearson College. We hope to see you there. Now, back to the conversation.
So, talking to our classmates about this, you know, how do you think people should be thinking about environmental issues as far as where they can have the greatest personal impact? Is it in government-facing advocacy and litigation like you do? Is it working through the private sector? Is it personal action, you know, whether they drive a electrical vehicle or not? You know, where can people have the biggest impact, and how should they think about their own personal responsibility for the environmental issues you've spent your life devoted to?
Yeah, so I'll give you one answer, but it's not the only answer. And my answer is there are a tremendous number of places to have a difference. And so the real key is to find a way. It may, you know, that's the substance, the issue that you're working on, but also the kind of work that just lines up best with who you are. And it took me some time to find that. But I do feel that the potential, and it's why I went to Washington in the first place, the potential of the federal government to do good in the most efficient way is tremendous. And unfortunately, we're not capitalizing on that potential right now. And that's why I think the work on the ground in localities all across the country is so important right now. One of the things I've done since I've come to Laramie is I serve on this planning commission for the city of Laramie. And I think that kind of work right now is probably even more important than what might be done on the federal level.
That's interesting. Why is that?
Well, I think, again, it's like, I mean, look, you mentioned earlier these shifting political winds, and the policy pendulum is just swinging further and further. And so, in my mind, the way to have lasting impact and produce lasting change is, again, it comes back to conversation, but it comes back to finding the solutions. I'd like to believe that you can act based on consensus, but a lot of times you can't. But even when you can't, you need to be operating in a way where people feel like they've at least been heard. And so that happens locally. I've seen it happen locally. And I think we need to build that lasting change from the bottom up.
So you've recently, you said earlier, made a change, and now you're not just, you were, in addition to doing the NRDC work, you're a professor, you're teaching in law school. What has that change been like?
Well, and I think that change was motivated in part because I recognized, as we probably all are at this point in our lives, that, you know, we're not going to accomplish everything that we feel is important to accomplish in our own lifetimes. So it got me a lot more interested in teaching these last few years than I had been before. And it's very refreshing to be doing it in Wyoming. I think the students come to the classroom. You know, so last spring I taught public land law, and people here are living with the public lands in a lot of different ways. And so they're really bringing, the students really brought their whole selves to the subject matter. And that was very refreshing and rewarding. It's interesting because I think, following my intramural success as an athlete, I recognized that I wasn't going to be able to compete at that level forever and ever. So I actually turned to coaching, and I did coach. I've got two daughters, and I coached them in basketball. It was just rec basketball, so it wasn't necessarily high quality basketball, but I coached them.
Oh, I coach rec basketball too. It can be very high quality.
Okay.
Well, it's certainly a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, for 12 years I did that, and I watched them grow from these third graders that barely hit the backboard to, you know, a kind of a team that was really working well together. And so I think that same joy that I got out of coaching, I'm finding in the classroom in terms of developing people who are going to carry on after us.
What are the most important skills you think you need to impart to these students or help foster in these students, if you're not imparting to themselves, but, you know, what are you trying to develop with them?
Yeah, so that's a really good question too, because the substantive knowledge of the law is only a tiny piece, I think, of what they need. One thing that I'm really emphasizing, and so in the class that I'm teaching, because I am still working full time, is a very practically oriented class. And so I think the skills that involve acting in a finite period of time are really important. So, you know, finding the material that you need quickly and then digesting it, recognizing that you're not going to be able necessarily to polish it in the way that we might have, like when we were working on our senior essay at Yale, but focusing on what's most important and how to communicate that quickly and powerfully would be one thing. And then the other thing I think is just kind of and this is hard to teach, but bringing both an open mind and an open heart to the issues that people are going to be working on as they go out into the working world, because that's what we need right now, I think, to get past this era of division and polarization that we find ourselves in.
So do you find in the classroom people are doctrinaire in an unhelpful way about environmental issues? And if so, how do you confront that or deal with it?
So I've been pleasantly surprised that people are not. And it's I've been very conscious about making sure that I'm not that way when I come into the classroom, and that I'm bringing in perspectives from other sides of the table so that they are hearing a lot of different views, and that I'm not, look, as a professor, you're automatically set up, I guess, with this kind of aspect of authority, which I don't want to abuse or take advantage of. So in some ways, I bend over backwards to make sure I'm not bringing ideological or rigid approach to the issues. So I think creating that climate of conversation is really important. But even though people are coming from dramatically different perspectives, I mean, you know, they grew up on a ranch, they're still trying to figure out how to help their family sustain that ranch that relied on federal grazing rights. A couple people were in the oil business before they came to law school. And so people are coming at the issues from different perspectives than I am. But I think everybody wants to find solutions. People see, and the economy of Wyoming has to find some solutions, because what's worked in the past isn't going to work going forward. So people are coming to the classroom looking for solutions, and that requires them to listen to different perspectives and try to find that common ground.
So if you look ahead 10 years, 15 years to our 50th reunion, which I can't believe I'm even saying, but if you have something on your professional or basketball bucket list, you know, what is that you want to accomplish with everything you've learned? Because you've got to this unbelievable amount of knowledge and background. How do you want to implement it in the next 10, 15 years? How are you thinking about that?
Well, this may be naive on my part, but my vision is that Wyoming as a state has a collective vision itself for the future that embraces the opportunities in the energy and natural resource space that exists, as opposed to still trying to cling desperately to the way things were done in the past. And that's not going to happen easily. There aren't easy answers. And we talk about a transition and retraining, but you got to recognize where people are coming from and the pain that's happening as a result of this transition in the energy economy. And you have to address that. You can't ignore it. So I think being at a place 10 years from now where the state and the university here, because the university is tied to the economics and the revenue that comes from oil and gas, right, and coal right now, that there can be this sense of positive momentum rather than fear of the change. And I'd like to be a small part of that if I can.
My brother used to live in Wyoming, and we I've visited him a number of times in the Tetons. So, yeah, the physical beauty of Wyoming is really, really can't be overstated. Are there parts of Wyoming that you never visited before you moved there that have really resonated with you as special places?
Yeah, I'm just excited now. This is getting back to what keeps me energized. Just the opportunity to explore the state and the recognition that throughout the state, there are these pockets of beauty and serenity that aren't obvious at first. So one area in particular is the Red Desert, which is, I'm on Laramie is the very eastern side of the state. The Tetons are the very western side of the state. The Red Desert is kind of right in the middle, just north of the town of Rock Springs, Green River. It's this huge expanse that when you fly over, it looks like nothing. I mean, it looks incredibly barren. Even when you drive on the main road through it, it looks like nothing. But once you get off the main road, you see that there are pockets of like even glorious aspen trees that you wouldn't expect. And so that, I guess that unexpected discovery is one of the things that most excites me about being in Wyoming. And it's interesting, I mean, we didn't have the opportunity to come here really until our daughters had kind of entered their next phase of life as they went off to college. And our oldest one is now graduated from college. And at first, we weren't sure how they would embrace this move to Wyoming, because we basically did pick up roots. We sold the house that they grew up in, and there isn't a place necessarily for them to return to where their friends are from high school. But they're excited about, and they've come a couple times to Wyoming. They ended up spending some of the pandemic here because they left their colleges. And so as we've all tried to do, just get through that period, and we're still getting through it as best we can. But the wilds of Wyoming, it's nice to have had the chance to kind of circle back to the wild aspects that really, drew me into the profession and the life that I've had the good fortune to lead since leaving Yale.
So now we're at the part of our podcast where we do our lightning round, some quick answer questions. So here we go. What food have you started to eat in Wyoming that you would recommend to a visitor that you can't find other places?
Because I was going to say pizza is pretty good here, but you can find that in a lot of other places.
Okay. Does it rival New Haven pizza? Not honestly.
No, that's not a fair question. It doesn't. but it's been one of our staples. And that's, I have to admit, that's probably because there are a limited number of culinary options in Laramie. But I will admit, surprisingly, that I've been eating more vegetarian options. And there's a great vegetarian restaurant here in Laramie, Sweet Melissa, for anybody who comes through here on I-80. It's definitely worth a stop to say hi and also try a Sweet Melissa in Laramie.
If there was a book or a documentary you think a classmate should check out on environmental issues, what would you recommend?
Whoa, that's a good question, but I'm not sure I have an answer to that. I was prepared for the question about the class that I wish I had taken.
All right. Well, we can go to that one too. That's right. Okay, well, what class do you wish you had taken?
I didn't take anything in the American West. And so I really regret not having taken Howard Lamar's class on the history of the American West. And I've gone back to his reading list several times because, really having a sense of the past is critically important to, how we navigate the present and the future. So that's my answer to that question.
Fair enough. That's good. Is there a class you did take at Yale that has shaped you?
So I would say that it was actually Diana Kleiner's class on Roman art and architecture. I ended up as a classics major at Yale, and it really, I guess what I loved about that class, and there were other classes like this too, but she just was really able to make the art and architecture of Rome come alive, and to have that, to experience that passion and love for a subject matter, I think was one of the best things that I took away from Yale.
Last question. When you're talking about New Haven pizza, what are the toppings that you think are required?
Pepperoni and black olives.
Ooh, good combination. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been great talking to you, and I hope to see you in June at our reunion.
A lot of fun, Tim. Great to talk to you.
In a world where people were isolated by a pandemic, forced to live their lives remotely in an endless parade of Zoom meetings, one Yale College class dared to break the mold. The Yale College class of 1987 is planning what no Yale College class has ever tried before, at least not for a while. an in-person reunion. June 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th, 2022. We will be gathering in Pearson College. Be there for engaging discussions, nightly revelry, and way too much New Haven pizza, if there ever could be such a thing. We'll wrestle with age-old questions like, maybe I look better in a mask, what do you think? Who or what is a Bula? What in the world am I going to do with no kids in the house? These questions and more will be answered at our 35th college reunion. Be there. 1 Yale College class dared to break the mold. That's it for today. Thanks so much for tuning in. This has been the Y87 Podcast, the official podcast of the greatest class that Yale College has ever known. We hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any comments or questions or would like to appear as a guest, please email me at timothy.p.harkness@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Such a thing. We'll wrestle with age-old questions like, maybe I look better in a mask. What do you think? Who or what is a Bula? What in the world am I going to do with no kids in the house? These questions and more will be answered at our 35th college reunion. Be there. That's it for today. Thanks so much for tuning in. This has been the Y87 Podcast, the official podcast of the greatest class that Yale College has ever known. We hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any comments or questions or would like to appear as a guest, please email me at timothy.p.harkness@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you.